From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The past is never dead, as William Faulkner told us. It isn't even past. Even now, the people of Tulsa, Oklahoma, are grappling with the tortured inheritance of what happened on May 31st, 1921, when an incensed white mob descended on a prosperous black neighborhood called the Greenwood District. The carnage that ensued is one of the most deadly racist attacks in the nation's history. Yet it took almost a full century and a hit HBO show for public officials to acknowledge the full weight of the story, to authorize a search for unmarked mass graves, to ensure local schools taught students about the violent incident, and to ensure they were taught about it in a way that it captured what really happened. Today, we'll talk about what it means to take on a heritage that is so onerous and so important. This hour on Point, reckoning with the legacy of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Joining me first is Jay Connor. He's a staff writer for The Root, host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast, and is, importantly for today's discussion, a Tulsa native. Jay Connor, welcome to On Point.
What's going on, man?
So you wrote this piece that really piqued my interest about this, in which you talked a bit about the debates going on. You talked about this historical event, but you also talked about the fact you didn't know about it as a school child from the schools. You didn't learn about this coming up in Tulsa. How do you learn about the Tulsa Race Massacre?
Much like, you know, many of the unsavory parts of American history, I had to rely on my parents to teach me about this. My parents were the ones that had that responsibility to teach me. And it was interesting because it's very different to learn about something that doesn't directly influence you whenever you're, you know, in this instance, I'm learning about a history that directly affected me because I'm from Tulsa. I'm living in the city. I'm seeing the reactions and I'm seeing the responses and how, you know, the repercussions of everything that's occurred. So also, I went to a church in the 80s, a mega church called Higher Dimensions, and we had survivors of the massacre that were actually attendants at our church as well.
Really? How old were you?
I think I was about like 9, 10.
And so you're 9 or 10 years old. You're at church. You're in Tulsa. Yeah. What do you hear from these survivors?
I don't remember having direct, conversations with them directly. But I mean, I knew of them. Mm-hmm. And I know that, you know, other people within the church held them within a certain level of reverence mm-hmm. and understanding that the price that they paid and the sacrifices they made for the rest of us.
So do you remember what your parents told you?
A little bit. I mean, my dad is like, you know, super pro-black and made sure that we understood and, you know, that he did his part to impart us with, you know, black history knowledge because a lot of that stuff wasn't going on in school. But I just remember him, you know, just primarily him as well as my mom, just really kind of, breaking down like what happened and the repercussions of it and kind of making me understand, you know, the racial wealth gap and how that kind of contributed to it and how this massacre was used to kind of keep us, you know, to keep us docile and keep us in an inferior position.
So I'd like to play a clip for you. A couple of clips, I guess, from Olivia Hooker. She was 6 years old. It sounds like you already remember Ms. Hooker. She was 6 years old during the incident in 1921. She spoke to NPR's All Things Considered about her remarkable life just 2 years ago when she was 103. Her memories of that night were still vivid. Let's listen.
At first, we saw a bunch of men with those big pine torches come through the backyard. And I remember our mother put us under the table. She took the longest tablecloth she had to cover four children and told us not to say a word. It was a horrifying thing for a little girl that's only 6 years old, trying to remember to keep quiet so they wouldn't know we were there.
Jay Connor, then Hooker described to the show what she saw and heard that day. Let's listen to that too.
They took a huge axe and started whacking at my sister Irene's beloved piano. Whack, whack, whack. It was a good piano, and they thought that was something we shouldn't have.
Now, Olivia Hooker became the first black woman to enlist in the Coast Guard, and she became a distinguished psychology professor at Fordham University. She passed away later that year in November 2018 at the age of 103. Jay Conner, that sort of gives a little texture. We'll be talking later with the historian Hannibal Johnson this hour, but that gives a little texture of what people experienced. Hundreds of homes destroyed, up to 300 people estimated killed that night, really a part of Tulsa destroyed for black residents there. And yet, as you wrote in your piece in The Root, for many people, for many Americans, for even many Oklahomans, a big HBO show really helped to illuminate this issue, not a documentary, but a Marvel product.
Right, right. It was a Watchmen series. Mm-hmm. And that's actually DC.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm a comic book head, so I had to correct you. It was actually, you know, the popularity of The Watchmen. Uh-huh. And I think historically it's important to note that oftentimes it requires pop culture, you know, television, film, whatever, you know, these different things to kind of bring awareness to these things. You know what I'm saying? Because when you look at, you know, Watchmen's a perfect example as far as people watch it and they couldn't believe that this actually happened. And they're like, no, this can't be real. So then they end up, you know, doing their research and finding out that, yes, this actually happened. And another example of this, as far as, you know, pop culture kind of shifting, you know, creating a paradigm shift and holding people accountable for their actions is when They See Us dropped last year. We saw that, you know, that movie came out and it did, you know, very well, critically acclaimed. But all the prosecutors that were involved in getting the Central Park Five convicted and, you know, unfairly and unjustly, you know, instituted within the criminal justice system, they were getting their books, you know, their book deals dropped. They were getting, you know, fired from their professor gigs and things like that. So, I mean, it's interesting to see how there's a correlation between the two. And, I mean, even most recently with the release of the Malcolm X documentary on Netflix, we saw that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is now conducting a preliminary review of the convictions related to his murder. So, you know, it's
in 1965.
Right. So it's interesting how, you know, pop culture kind of has, you know, kind of been the catalyst for this.
Take a moment and explain a little bit about how, you know, it's one thing to do a feature film like was done for the Central Park Five about the incident. It's another thing to do a documentary, as you just mentioned, about Malcolm X. In this case, you're taking this massacre, this attack, this assault, and infusing it into what was a comic book story brought to life, right? How was that done for those folks who didn't see the series in a way that was so tangible and visceral for those who saw it?
Unfortunately, I haven't been able to see it either, but I heard about it. And from what I understand is just they just did a tremendous job of just really kind of just nailing that the importance of it home and to really kind of illustrating, you know, what exactly transpired. And it was just so daunting and so, you know, amazing, you know, just horrifying, I should say, not amazing, but so horrifying that people just literally, you know, hopped on Google and they're like, there's no way this really happened. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So, and how do you judge as somebody who's assessing this, that this really did have an effect in that way, that the Watchmen in some part helped spur attention?
Well, I mean, the way that I judge it is the fact that, like, I lived there. I experienced it. I mean, not the massacre, but the fact that it was omitted from history conveniently. And if we look at, you know, education throughout the country, you know, they're going to be very deliberate and calculated in how they, you know, disseminate this information. I mean, if you look at, you know, the Native American boarding schools, they're very particular in how they discuss that, or Japanese internment. When it comes to marginalized groups, you know, historically, America does not look out for our best interests. And they, you know, in omitting this information, they're purposely keeping us docile.
We've had a couple of commenters online on Facebook and on Twitter. Rebecca tweets, I grew up in Tulsa. I left when I was 8. I didn't hear about this until about 2 years ago. Michael Beach posts on Facebook on our page. He says, I graduated from an Oklahoma school in 1987. I didn't learn about the riots until I was in my 20s. It's something we need to teach for sure. Learning about the atrocities of our past helps healing. And Belisa Veris Moriarty writes, it should be taught in all states. I had no idea this happened until I saw it on The Watchmen. So speaking to your very point there. Jay Conner, how much of this is felt you know, you're now, I think you're joining us from Charlotte today in North Carolina. You don't live in Tulsa currently. How much is this felt as an Oklahoma thing, a Tulsa thing, and how much do you think this speaks to what African Americans experience nationally?
I'm sorry, repeat that last part again. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, how much you think this is something that Tulsa and Oklahoma has to reckon with, and how much do you think that this is part of a greater national narrative?
Oh, definitely. You know, it's we're talking about one of the largest racial, you know, violence history, one of the largest examples of racial history, racial violence history in the, you know, in the history of the United States. So, I mean, it definitely has a profound effect throughout the country, especially when we talk about matters in regards to the racial wealth gap. You know what I mean? We're talking about, you know, one of the thriving economies, one of the thriving black economies within the country that was just completely decimated deliberately. And I mean, at the time, Tulsa was heavily segregated, but I mean, they knew what they were doing in doing this. And I think that it's also important to mention that we are careful about the language we use, because a riot insinuates that this was a mutual situation. This was a clear massacre. This is hundreds, an estimated 300, I believe, from a 2001 commission, people that were murdered, and nearly 800 who were also injured. Solely because of this child who they believed, you know, acted inappropriately with this young white girl. So I think it's important that we use the proper language in addressing the situation as well.
You've been hearing there from Jay Connor, staff writer at The Root, host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Jay Connor, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
We're continuing to discuss this hour the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, its enduring legacy, and the evolving Oklahoma school curriculum that seeks to acknowledge what happened and commemorate the people and community that were wiped away. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 that took the lives of hundreds of residents in the Greenwood District, an African-American neighborhood referred to as Black Wall Street. We have made a call out for Sooners, particularly Tulsans who grew up. We want to know how they learned about this, what, if anything, they were taught about this. We're getting comments online. We're also receiving callers. I want to take one before we go to our next guest. We're hearing from Towson, Maryland. Kyle is calling in. Kyle, thanks for listening today. What are your thoughts?
Hi, thank you. First of all, I grew up in South Tulsa, which was not the Greenwood part of town, but the predominantly white part of town. I'm in a white family that had been in Oklahoma for over 100 years. And I had never heard anything about it growing up. And I actually went to a private and I would say fairly liberal-minded and creative, you know, arts-minded school. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't on their curriculum either to teach mm-hmm. this. But my junior year in high school, I remember it so clearly, we had a substitute teacher for about 2 months. And she was a recent college graduate, Ivy League college graduate, who had grown up in the same community in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And she came back to teach this English class. And the first week she was teaching, she said, I just remember it so clear. She said, okay, everybody, put your textbooks and everything back under your desk. All I want you to have is a notebook and a pencil. And I'm going to tell you something you've never heard before. It's probably going to blow your mind. And she told us all about what they then called the Tulsa Race Riots, which I know now was a misnomer. But we all just stared wide-eyed looking at each other like, are you kidding me? Here in Tulsa, this happened? And none of us had ever heard a thing about it. And I had been to the north side of town. It was always considered the dangerous part of town, and the Greenwood area, like, oh, don't get caught there at night or something. And it was, and it's sad to look back that was how we thought of it, and that I didn't know this richer history that it had, but also the tragic history. And it's so great, I want to say now, that to see that the mayor of Tulsa and the leadership in Tulsa are at least trying in some way to confront it. I know they've been working on researching and finding any mass burial sites that might exist, one of which is deep in South Tulsa, ironically, that has always been known to be an African-American cemetery, predominantly African-American cemetery in the deep white part of town. But now apparently they're going to be looking at researching it and possibly digging up mass graves there.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for this. That is fascinating. I got to imagine any time a teacher says, I'm going to teach you something you've never heard about, you listen. When it's this, your jaw must have just dropped. It must have been an extraordinary, I don't know if it was day or days that you spent on this terrible history. But it sounds like it stayed with you in the decades since.
It did. And I also remember thinking like it was English class, but there wasn't a lot of reading material that she could offer us about it either.
Huh.
You know, I think that even the newspaper articles and things that he went to the library, it was very hard to find anything from that time. So it was almost this word of mouth transference of this story. And a few years later, when I started working in the film industry, I was talking about the story because I would talk about it in college and to my friends and be like, you never believe this. And then I remember the producer I was working with said, I've got a treatment for a miniseries that somebody wants to do about the Tulsa race riots. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, my God, that's fantastic. Obviously nothing ever happened with it. But it was nice to see it, I think fairly respectfully honored in the DC Comics series, The Watchmen, too.
Well, thank you for that, Kyle. We appreciate that so much. I want to now bring in a historian who is working on a lot of the issues Kyle just raised. Hannibal Johnson is joining us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He is the Education Committee Chair of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission, and he's also author of the forthcoming book, Black Wall Street 100, An American City Grapples with Its Historical Racial Trauma. Hannibal Johnson, thanks so much, and welcome to On Point.
Hello, David.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the issues we're raising this hour, some of the things that Kyle talked about. He talked about the fact that there weren't a whole ton of resources for him a couple decades ago as a student to go to the library and learn more about this, at least not the ones that he could find. How has our understanding of what happened in 1921 changed in recent years? And what are you guys doing about it?
Well, I think one of the pivot points was the convening of the 1921 commission to study the riot and make recommendations back in 1997. They issued a report in February of 2001, which is a comprehensive, award-winning report. And that report generated a lot of media attention, not just locally or nationally, but internationally. And from that point, a number of other resources were made available, including a number of books, scholarly articles, a lot more interest in investigating the series of events that led to 1921 and its aftermath. So there are resources available today. I happen to work with the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission, and part of our work involves curriculum reform, making sure that this history is infused properly into all levels of curriculum. We've even created a teachers' institute in the summer beginning in 2018 where we bring together teachers, teach them this history, the substance of the history, but also teach them pedagogy, how to teach the history not just to students but to other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So the information is being disseminated much more widely and broadly than ever before. The series Watchmen was catalytic in the sense that it generated a lot of interest in the true history. This is a fictional account, but the opening sequence of Watchmen was actually a vivid, powerful, and authentic imagining of what it must have been like to be black and to be in Tulsa when black Tulsa was under siege in 1921.
I want to take a call now from Michelle in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in today, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick comment. So I've been in Oklahoma my entire life. I'm in my 30s now, and I have typical conservative values being from a conservative state, including about the role of federal government. However, when it comes to our history, especially the history of black Americans, in Oklahoma. I think we need federal intervention like we've seen in the days of old where they came in and they made the population of certain states take seriously the issues involving its minority population. We have serious deniers in Oklahoma, and I think a lot of places around the nation would be very surprised to see how much systemic racism still exists in Oklahoma.
Hey, Michelle, can you stay with us for a second? When you say they're deniers there, is that related to what we're talking about today, specifically in terms of the race massacre in Tulsa? Is that about something else more broadly? What do you mean?
No, specifically about the Tulsa race massacre. I mean, if you monitor any of the local news sources, anytime they have been reporting on this new feature, this film that's come out about the massacre, you will see that a majority of our population refuse to refer to it as a massacre. They insist on claiming that there was some mutual combat taking place or that there was something that the African-American community did in Tulsa to deserve what occurred.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating, a form of local denialism. And you're seeing that play out even in mainstream news organizations, professional journalistic outfits, local TV stations or the newspapers in town, things like that.
Absolutely. And it's certainly absent from our curriculum. And I think that's a federal issue.
Michelle, thank you so much for your call. Hannibal Johnson, I'm seeing on Twitter a comment from another listener, Jennifer Perry, who writes, I think there was a quick mention of Tulsa race riots when I was in elementary schools in Oklahoma City. Calling it a riot gave me an impression of black people revolting and wreaking havoc. Only in the last couple of years have I started to hear about what actually happened. You know, Hannibal, it strikes me that at minimum, a riot suggests that there's a melee on two sides at least, right? And it seemed to me that this incident was really minor and there was a response from blacks and to try to protect a young black boy. And then there was this attack. Tell us what actually happened. You know, give us an encapsulated version of what really we're talking about when we talk about Tulsa in 1921.
You know, it's important really to first establish a national context for what happened in Tulsa in 1921. 1921 comes on the heels of 1920, 1919 especially. In 1919, there were more than two dozen so-called race riots throughout the United States in places as far-flung as New York and Baltimore, Memphis, Omaha, Washington, D.C., Longview, Texas, Elaine, Arkansas, and I could go on and on and on. James Weldon Johnson of the NAACP called 1919, the summer and fall of 1919, Red Summer, red being a metaphor for the blood that flowed throughout the streets of communities throughout the United States. Historians and sociologists are prone to call the early part of the 20th century in America the nadir of race relations in America, the low point of race relations. So what happened in Tulsa in 1921 is different in terms of magnitude and severity, but it really is emblematic of the kind of racial violence that was occurring throughout the United States. And there are a number of factors particular to Tulsa that led to this outbreak. One was land lust, that is, the community of Greenwood, the African-American community, sat on land that abutted downtown Tulsa, separated by the Frisco tracks. And so there were industrialists and railroad interests that wanted that land. There was, of course, garden variety jealousy of the success of people in the Greenwood community, Black Wall Street, people who owned cars and homes and fine clothes and such, in an era in which white supremacy reigned supreme. So how could those people be better off than white people? The media, there was a media outlet called the Tulsa Tribune here, a daily afternoon newspaper, that published a series of inflammatory, incendiary articles and editorials that really fanned the flames of white hostility against the black community. So it's a combination of those things and the growth and development of the Klan in Oklahoma and in Tulsa in the 1920s, peaking in the late 1920s. All that was needed was something to ignite this tinderbox. And the igniter was an event involving two teenagers, Dick Rowland, 19-year-old black shoeshine boy, Sarah Page, 17-year-old white girl who operated an elevator. Dick Rowland needed to use the restroom on this day, May 30th, 1921. He went to a downtown building called the Drexel Building. He knew there was an elevator. He knew that there was a restroom located on the third floor of that building. He had to take an elevator. Sarah Page was operating the elevator. He got on the elevator door closed. Something happened that caused the elevator to jerk or to lurch. Dick Rowland bumped into Sarah Page. Sarah Page screamed. The elevator landed back in the lobby. Dick Rowland ran from the elevator. Sarah Page exited. She was distraught, comforted by a locally owned store clerk from a store called Renberg's. And the Tulsa Tribune got wind of the story and actually sensationalized it tremendously. They characterized the incident as an attempted rape. They made Sarah Page look more virtuous than she actually was, which, as a corollary, made Dick Rowland look more villainous than he actually was. Sarah Page would ultimately refuse to cooperate with the prosecution, but before her recantation of the initial story, the Tribune's coverage really inflamed the white community, led to ultimately the violence that devastated the Greenwood community in 1921. The violence itself lasted about 16 hours, but the damage it wrought, you know, the loss of some 100 to 300 lives, millions of dollars in property damage, the internment of African-Americans, African-Americans spending days, weeks, and months living in tent cities set up by the Red Cross, which provided relief effort. It was a stunning and devastating blow to the black community, specifically into Tulsa in general, in 1921.
I'd like to remind listeners we're interested in hearing from them, for all listeners, for Oklahomans, Sooners in particular, whether native Sooners or people who live there now. What do you want to know about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 and its legacy? What do you remember learning about it? I'd like to take a call now from Morehead City, North Carolina. I believe it's Caria. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Caria. Thanks for listening. Tell us your thoughts today.
Yes, I had heard first of the complete razing of the town of Rosewood, Florida, as the first complete destruction of a thriving black community, and its absolute erasure from all history books. And this was my first encounter with this sort of thing. And this makes me think that there must be hundreds of these incidents all over the United States that have been erased from the history books. There needs to be a federal inquiry into what has happened to all of these thriving black communities that must have existed and were razed.
Well, thank you for that, Carrie. I appreciate that. And we've got just the person talking about that, Hannibal Johnson, a historian who's, as we've heard, has a greater context for this. Walter Schaub, who's a former top federal official in government ethics, he tweeted back at us today. He said, similarly, how many people were taught about the battle at Wounded Knee as kids instead of the massacre at Wounded Knee? It was a horrific massacre. The lies have got to stop. The idea being, you know, that history has to be reconciled with the truth of what actually happened. Hannibal Johnson, we have only a couple minutes left before the end of this segment, although we're obviously continuing on through the entire hour on this important topic. But when I think about it, you know, I was reading something and learning more about this and about the recent way in which Oklahomans have handled this. It's only recently that officials authorized the idea of looking at certain areas in Tulsa to see if they actually were unmarked graves for the bodies of the victims of this massacre. You know, we're talking about 90 plus years later. What is the hope with that? And also, why did it take so long to get this authorized?
Well, the beginning of this mass graves investigation started in 1997 with the convening of that commission I mentioned, which was officially called the Oklahoma Commission to Study the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. That was the official name of the commission. That body disassembled in 2001, issued a final report, which is comprehensive. But part of the work of that commission initially was to follow up on historical evidence, oral history, and some written documentation that there were, in fact, mass graves in Tulsa. So that was looked at by that commission. Even some archaeological scientific work was done on particular sites. But the commission sunsetted, and the work went incomplete. So our current mayor, G.T. Bynum, learning about this history as an adult, became committed. I think he made a pledge when he was a city councilor to, if he ever had the power and authority, to further look into this prospect of mass graves, to answer the unanswered historical questions that still linger. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing now is following up on the material, the documentation provided by the first commission, looking at particular sites, doing additional scientific investigation. Science has advanced in 20 years, so the scientific equipment is much more sensitive in terms of detecting anomalies under the ground. Right now, there's the possibility of doing an excavation in April at one of the particular sites.
All right. We're discussing 2 days of carnage in Tulsa, Oklahoma, nearly a century ago that destroyed a thriving black community and became recognized as one of the deadliest racist attacks in U.S. history. We're also talking about how modern-day Oklahomans are reconciling themselves to that very history. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the Tulsa race massacre of 99 years ago and the challenge of getting the history right for society and for the state schools today. With us, Hannibal Johnson, author and education committee chair of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. And joining me now from Tulsa, Joe Nelson. He's an AP language and composition teacher at Will Rogers College High School. Joe, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David.
So, you're a teacher. You're there to inform the kids. How is this taught in your school?
In our school, we do have a few history teachers who are looking at this from a historical perspective. In my classroom, I wanted to make sure that my students knew the story because it's not something that I grew up with, even though I'm from a small town north of here. So for me, it was really about making sure that they understood what had happened and what had occurred in 1921, but know the full history of the Greenwood District, going from the beginning of the Greenwood District through the events of 1921, and then looking at that rejuvenation as well.
Take us inside the classroom. What is that? I mean, I actually appreciate the fact that you're approaching it not just simply as, hey, there was this thing and they're victims, but hey, there's this vibrant community. Let's teach you about it. Let's tell you about that first, and let's talk about the consequences after. But take me in the classroom. If I'm a student there, what am I hearing you talk about? What am I hearing, seeing you present?
Well, when I first really got into this work, and I actually learned much of what I know from Hannibal Johnson, we were looking at the actual history of what occurred in Greenwood, but it soon became apparent in my classroom as I started to present the information to the student that I had students coming to this with a lot of different points of knowledge. I had some students who their families were talking about it, or maybe they had heard about it from an elementary teacher, so they had some knowledge. I had other students in the classroom who maybe had heard the term but really didn't know anything about it, and I had other students who maybe hadn't really heard the term. So in the classroom, instead of just trying to make sure that they understood my point of view, we approached it from adults are wrestling with whether this was a riot or a massacre. We heard that because the first time that Tulsa put on our Tulsa, the Institute for Teachers, we called it the Tulsa Race Riot Institute. And then we changed it to the Tulsa Race Massacre Institute. So the overall question that we were looking at in our classroom was, as we looked at videos of residents from Greenwood, as we looked at Dr. Olivia Hooker's interview of being a survivor, as we looked at the overall video from Dr. Hannibal Johnson, and we looked at opinion pieces from the Tulsa World over the past 2 years, I wanted students to wrestle with the same question that adults are. Was this a riot or was this a massacre? And
did you have any doubt in your own mind of how you felt about it?
Absolutely not. These were horrific events. And so for me, I always use the term massacre because that's what it was. But I also wanted students to be able to look at those primary sources, because when you start to listen to residents of Greenwood, when you start to listen to like Dr. Hooker, when you start to look at the photos of what happened, it's pretty clear. And I wanted students to be able to see those rather than me just telling them a story.
Obviously, we live in a multiracial time, but I wonder whether what kind of reaction you got from, say, African-American students versus white students. Was there any separation there? Was there a difference in the nature of their response to you?
Absolutely. Originally, this was intended to be about a one-week unit that we were going to go through. It ended up being 3 weeks because I underestimated that in the classroom. This was an emotional issue. This was not just about events, but as you look at a photo, students would start bringing up other events that are happening in the world today and start making those connections. And there were some of our African-American students, when they would look at it, you could tell that they were getting angry. You could tell that they were upset that other students didn't know this, and they wanted to know why they hadn't been presented that information. You had other students who wanted to know why they had never heard about it.
Fascinating. And do you get a sense, I mean, you said that you didn't learn about this growing up. You grew up in, you're an Oklahoman. You grew up
Correct.
Not so far in a town not so far from Tulsa. You didn't know about it yourself. How did you draw upon your own experiences to figure out how to teach this to the kids?
Well, I learned about this when I was 19. It was in the early 90s, and a friend just looked out the window and said, hey, I think that's where some of the mass graves are. And I had no idea what he was talking about.
Jeez.
And so I learned about the basics from him. But again, I think I heard somebody else on the program talk about how we didn't have the resources that we have today. And so for me, as I approached it in the classroom, I approached it as I'm a learner with my students. And some of them have experiences that I don't have. And I need to learn from them just as much as they need to. I need to help them find the information. And there were days in class where I would just sit down and I would let the students take control of the conversation. I mean, I made sure that we were being respectful and I made sure that we were keeping things appropriate. But I also wanted them to know that I am not an expert on this. I'm learning about all of this right alongside them.
Joe, before I let you go, what did you make of those who are, you know, in a sense, your betters, those who are in the Capitol there, those who are running the school boards there, who hadn't made sure that you learned about that some decades ago, who hadn't until recently made sure that your charges learned about this, that you were in the position that you were learning about this too, along with your students?
I think we have to understand that this is history, this is academic content, but there's probably a reason why we haven't talked about this, and that's because we don't want to face things that make us uncomfortable, and we don't want to ask hard questions. And we're going to have to accept that we may have to be uncomfortable in order to have some of these conversations. And I really believe that if we are going to move forward, if we're going to start that healing, we've got to start by educating these students today. If we can't teach them in school how to have a conversation with somebody who maybe disagrees with them or somebody who has a conflicting viewpoint, it's not going to get any easier. We have to start the conversation now.
We've been hearing there from Joe Nelson on the front lines of that effort. He's a teacher at Will Rogers College High School in Tulsa. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you.
I'd like to take a couple of quick calls now. First, from Tulsa, Oklahoma, John's calling in. John, thanks for listening. Share your thoughts here.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. So like many of the same folks, I am coming up on 50, so was not talked about when I was in high school. I first learned about it in 1996 during the 75th anniversary when they first started talking about the commission. But, you know, the point that I want to make is, you know, Tulsans have a lot of pride in our city. It is a great town. And so when we didn't talk about it, it wasn't that there was a cover-up, you know, that we were looking to protect the KKK, Tate Brady and his Knights of Liberty, etc. It is shameful to us. And so it is like Joe was just saying, it's uncomfortable. And so I work with a couple of different organizations that we do education in the Greenwood District, specifically with tours and trying to enlighten people because it is a very, very difficult conversation. It's embarrassing for us here in Tulsa because that is not who we are. Even in 1921, that is largely not who we were. So many good things going on in Tulsa. And while there was a significant population or presence of the Klan in Tulsa, you know, the vast majority of Tulsans were abhorred by those incidents, the massacre, even back then. And okay, so John, that's why we kind of pushed it aside, because we don't want to talk about it for so long. It has been so uncomfortable and shameful on Tulsa.
And John, before I let you go, just as a quick question, if you don't mind sharing, yourself, are you white, or are you how do you identify
yourself? Uh-huh.
Terrific. I just wanted to get that as a data point as well. John, thank you so much for listening and for sharing your perspective. I wanted to offer Hannibal Johnson, the Tulsa historian, a chance to react to what he heard. That is, that it wasn't a cover-up, but that this was in some ways a shameful episode that didn't reflect how most Tulsans actually felt and therefore avoided.
Well, unfortunately, sometimes the greatest harm comes from the silence and inaction of the so-called good people. So Tulsa, while certainly there were good people who did helpful things after the devastation, including First Presbyterian Church downtown, Holy Family Cathedral, sheltered people, fed them, clothed them, etc., there were also many people in Tulsa who are responsible for electing the leadership that was in place at the time, part of which called the event a Negro uprising, and after the devastation tried to take the land for industrial and railroad purposes and move the black community farther north. So I think we have to own this travesty, and we have to recognize that it's not isolated. It's part of a pattern that pervaded the United States generally during the first part of the 20th century, and that we must have these courageous conversations around our true history, acknowledge as appropriate what happened, apologize as appropriate, and perhaps most importantly, atone for the damage that was done as best we can in the moment. So acknowledgement, apology, and atonement are the steps, in my mind at least, that are essential as we move along the road to reconciliation in this community and communities all throughout the United States.
We have a listener, Chris Stinch, who writes on Twitter, "As an Oklahoman, I'm so happy to hear you covering this. I learned about it my first year of college at ORU. I guess that's Oral Roberts University. But even then, the severity of it was diminished and was blamed more on black behavior that instigated it." We have a call now from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jacob, thank you for listening and thanks for calling in.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yes, sir.
I first learned about the song, about what happened in the mid to late 80s. I was about 10 years old. There's a band called the Gap Band from Tulsa, and it stands for Greenwood, Archer, and Pine, which are three predominantly streets in the Greenwood Cultural District. And so the song "You Dropped the Bomb on Me" was a love song, but my father told me it had a hidden meaning for the race riots of when they dropped the bomb on the Greenwood Cultural District, Black Wall Street. And so I'm full-blood Native American, so my father was always teaching me things about history as, hey, man can do anything against any other minority, so you need to pay attention to your past and learn. At the same time, they had the Japanese internment camps in Arkansas, not too far away. And the Osages were millionaires off oil and gas rights, and they were slowly becoming killed off one by one, and people stealing their money. Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio are actually going to be filming a film in Oklahoma, not too far from Tulsa, about those Osage murders. And so I think that's all tied in together with what happened in the history of Oklahoma. But my father, like I said, he educated me on the race riots. I didn't say race riots, but race massacre in the mid-80s, because the Gap Band is from Tulsa. They recently brought that up on another program to teach the youth and other adults. I think it should be taught. You shouldn't be taught by your parents things that should be taught in school. I mean, they're things that always, you know, that are swept under the rug. As a Native American, you were taught the Trail of Tears, but you were taught just a bit from the Cherokee tribe. You know, there were five other tribes that went through it, many others that were had our history basically erased. And I wish the state of Oklahoma would be like the state of Washington and Oregon and make Oklahoma Native American history a part of their curriculum, because there are 36 federally recognized Native American tribes in Oklahoma. And so we are the land of the red man. Oklahoma is what it stands for. So I think we should teach our history to ourselves as well.
Well, we'll make sure to post a link on our website to both the song You Dropped a Bomb on Me, the 1982 song by the Gap Band, but also to programs we've done and NPR has done on Osage Indians. Thank you so much for that call and that insight, Jacob. Hannibal Johnson, we have another comment from a listener who tweets, the late Ozier Muhammad, who tweets about the late historian John Hope Franklin, a Tulsa native who grew up at the time of the massacre. He talked and wrote about it, and Ozier writes, "This ignorance is deliberate. It's not taught in our schools for a reason, to further the myth of American exceptionalism." What do you think about that, Hannibal Johnson?
Well, I say that part of the reason that this history remained sub rosa, beneath the surface for so long, is a confluence of psychological dynamics. Fear, post-traumatic stress disorder, shame, guilt, blame, all those sorts of things. Tulsa at the time of the massacre was a booming community, booming city that had been a sort of a dusty outpost. Tulsa went on to call itself the oil capital of the world. So it's in the leadership, the white leadership of Tulsa's interest to minimize what happened in 1921 because Tulsa was taking its place on the national and the world stage. There was legitimate fear in the black community about a recurrence of these kinds of events. There was shame in sectors of the white community and guilt over what had happened. So all these things taken together, I think, create an atmosphere where it's rather easy to either be silent about or to minimize the devastation that happened here in Tulsa. Some would argue that there was, in fact, something more intentional, a conspiracy of silence to deliberately hide this. I will say that to exclude something of this magnitude from the curriculum actually does involve some level of intentionality. But that's the past, and we're in the present, so we have to grapple with the realities of our missteps and do the best we can, as quickly as we can, to incorporate this rich and robust history into our curriculum.
You've been hearing there from Hannibal Johnson. He's author and he's Education Committee Chair of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. Thanks so much for this great conversation.
You're welcome.
And folks, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. You know, I'd be remiss in failing to note, usually this program originates from Boston. I typically broadcast from here in New York City. It takes, as they say, a village to make that happen. It certainly takes a team to make it me sound seamless in the rare occasion I do. And to that, a lot of credit has gone to our director, Justine Down. She helped this new host ease into this role and produce. We say farewell to her today. She has been an air traffic controller, a horse whisperer, and of all things, a conscience. And we're so appreciative for all of that. She's off to new adventures in podcasting. I certainly suspect we'll see her back in news someday. She has an eye and an ear for it. A great thanks for her. We appreciate her. We appreciate the rest of the team at On Point, and we appreciate you for making this show as strong as it is. You've been listening to On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks to all.